IP.com. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Go Big, Go Bold IP show. My name is Carmine Dudisco. I have on the line my host, J.D. Hoovner. Hey, J.D., over there.
Hey, man. How are you today?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. It's a Monday morning. We're getting out of the cold snap here in Florida. We actually had to put on, take my shorts off. I had to put on sneakers, no more flip-flops. It got cold down here.
Oh, man, it's been so mild over here. You know, up in the Northeast, they're getting just slammed. So, yeah, no, we're feeling pretty fortunate over here and enjoying it, man.
No, I hear you. What'd you do over the weekend?
Oh, you know, cleaned up. We're New Year, trying to get the closet organized. So we made the pilgrimage to IKEA. And we've got, oh my gosh. And we started out with all this, you know, Pinterest type of a picture. And my wife is like, oh my gosh, we got kids. And so, yeah, we got some stuff home. But really, what's funny is that we end up buying these things. What we really needed to do is just clean, you know, and start and do the donation, do the division. So we're starting to go through some of that. That was the main weekend event. Our daughters were starting them up in soccer, and my oldest, she's only three, but I'm so proud of her. She's doing so good with the little kickers class she's in.
Yeah, that's great, man. It's so much fun, and moving. I'm right with you, man. Moving, I will do almost anything. You know, moving and organizing is just not something that, you know, the whole time I'm doing, I'm going, man, I could really be doing something that I like to do or something that really needs to be done, because I don't see it as something that has to be done, but obviously it needs to be. And then when I go to IKEA, it's like an all-day event there.
Yeah.
That place, it's like a maze, you know?
Yeah, but they're smart. They'll feed you, you know, and it's just comfortable. Check out the showroom, have a seat. Yeah. When I went there, I actually went – and that is hard. I went backwards. I went right to the warehouse. They make it very hard to do that. But we did. And so,
that's a great idea. Yeah. Just go to where you need to.
Yeah. It almost worked. And my wife was like, well, we don't know what this is going to look like. And so we ended up having a backtrack. Right. And if I was going by myself, that would certainly be what I do.
No, that's good, man. So, well, no, I'm glad we got you on the show today. I mean, it's awesome. I know that we're going to cover so many things with the intellectual property. And intellectual property, I know people throw that word around or that phrase around, but it encompasses so much. I mean, all business is really built around intellectual property in some way. I was thinking about that over the weekend. I wanted to talk to you about that. You know, people say, oh, I got to get a patent, but there's so many more things when you have a business besides just a patent, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. It's pretty cool, you know, and of course, being a professional in the industry, of course, that's, you know, my thing, but I mean, it's great in that, you know, looking at just innovation, and we've done things like innovation analysis and look at what's the culture of the business, you know, and making sure that innovating is part of your business, because it really should be. If you want to be competitive, if you want to have a niche, you do have to have that innovation spirit. And so those things that come about are all over the map, whether it's having trade secrets, you know, having internal knowledge, customer names, databases, software, maybe ways you know machines work really well that you train your staff on specifically, generating creative works. I mean, gosh, copyright law, you know, and just the things you write in blogs and software and source code, developing, you know, art, you know, artwork, brands, logos, and the way your website looks, that's all copyright law. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, your whole brand is built around in trademark law. So it is. Yeah, IP covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, and that's something that even myself, I've been in business my whole life. I've never really worked for anybody, and I've started and sold several businesses. And I never really thought about everything we did was some sort of intellectual property, or I own that. Even the people who were buying my businesses were never really too concerned about the things they were getting. It is getting a little bit more now as you get into upper upper dollars or the businesses are selling for a lot of money, you know, then the lawyers come in and a lot of things. So that's how I kind of realized the missteps I was making in the 90s and the late 80s, because I wasn't even documenting anything. I was just out there making money, you know, starting a business thinking that, man, I really knew what I was doing. But in fact, it's so important. It's really the intellectual property side is really your business worth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there are certainly lots of different ways to value a business, you know, and just like you said, you know, those, and I'm sure yours were not, you know, small businesses, but, you know, every business size, you know, really, really should be including intellectual property as part of their value. You know, what makes it up? It's a great way to talk with potential buyers if you're looking to sell about, hey, how do you allocate? You know, it's not just the cash flow. It's not just, you know, what's in the bank and what's the net, you know, profitability, to be able to look at it and say what assets belong to the business. You know, not, you know, if it's the brick and mortar and the equipment, fine, but intellectual property is really an asset. Mm-hmm. It's just like a deed to the house. You know, it's actual ownership, and there's definite value in that. But you've got to do some homework and understand who else might be interested in that. And so being able to say, you know, for patent, you know, if you've got an issued patent, working with an attorney or someone, a professional, help you understand how that differentiates from others in the market and how what that incremental change is. Working backwards from a demand point of view, you can definitely see, you know, what value that would be, even if you haven't monetized that patent yet, and put that into actual amount that someone will be willing to pay for in the free market. Mm.
Well, the patents are always, you know, at Inventor's Launchpad, and I'm sure you hear it a lot, so many times a day. It seems like the patent is the big part of intellectual property. Everybody talks about the patent side of it, and we know there's so much more. And I actually did get some questions in from our last show, and I maybe, you know, we can basically go from the beginning, and as you were talking earlier in the show, let's start right from the beginning and talk about what a patent actually is would be great. I did though get one question, and I wanted to ask you before, because we seem to always run out of time because it's
sure, yeah.
One of our listeners emailed, and basically it was a question for you, is, you know, what's the difference in going to school or taking a test for a regular lawyer? And I don't even want to use the word regular because I know it's hard to be a lawyer, but then the actual going for the patenting side of it or being a patent lawyer, is there any difference?
Yeah. Well, so there's two different tracks. And so to be an attorney, okay, you have to go to law school. There are actually a few states that do allow sort of an apprenticeship route as far as attorney goes. And you can actually study under a attorney. And as long as it's all documented and you sit for the state bar, okay, you can be an attorney. But as far as I know, to be an attorney, you must be it must have a bar number associated with one, at least one specific state. And so most states now are part of the uniform bar exam. And so, you know, you've got to go through all that, right? Course, law school, bar exam. That's an attorney. Now, apart from that, a totally separate track is the patent bar. Okay. And what's interesting, and a lot of people don't know this, is that you don't have to be an attorney to sit for the patent bar. And you do, however, have to meet certain qualifications. So in order to sit for the patent bar, you've got to have a technical background. And there's, you know, there's a lot of detail. There's three different ways you can qualify to sit. The primary way was the way I qualified was having a Bachelor of Science. And so there are certain qualifying programs, and as long as they're accredited programs, which most universities are, some aren't, you know, for example, engineering, science and math. You know, those are the big three. There are others that can sort of qualify, but you may need to get additional evidence. But that's, you know, this category A where you can sit for the patent bar. There's a category B where you simply study and pass what's called the fundamentals of engineering exam, FE exam. And that's the exam that a lot of professional engineers take when they're first graduating from college. And it's sort of this test that sort of tests across the board, all disciplines of engineering. It's a very challenging exam if you haven't taken the curriculum from a university, but some people have done that. So that's category B. And there's this third category, which is basically you've been an engineer by doing the work. You know, maybe you haven't gone to school, you haven't passed any tests, but you've been doing what an engineer does by trade, and you can prove that. That is probably the toughest one to do, to get the examination boards to sort of admit you to sit for the patent bar. Those are the three great big categories. Check that out. Go to USPTO.gov and look for more information there. But like I said, it's not required to go to law school. And that's what I did. I sat and passed the patent bar before I graduated law school and became what's called a patent agent. Patent agents are not attorneys, but they know the up and down everything that a patent attorney does about what it takes to get a patent issued and granted. And so they know the MPEP. It's the Manual for Practicing Examiners. There's more.
Yeah.
MPEP. Okay, go look that up. But that's the Bible. I mean, this thing is thousands of pages deep. And that is what is tested, really. And what's interesting is that that exam, it's computerized now, but it's open book. They've got a whole PDF. But the exam's so tough that you don't have time to search for the answers. I mean,
there you go.
You gotta know it. And a lot of times the answers are so detailed and it's in a, you know, scenario type of deal. It's not gonna help. The manual's always kind of constantly getting evolved, and of course had a huge change in 2013 with the American Invents Act. And so a lot of folks sitting for the bar even now are being tested on the law before AIA and after, where we are now in AIA, so they can help inventors that have applications that were pending that they filed back in 2012 or 2013, that sort of cross over this pre-post law. So folks that are attorneys and that have passed the separate patent bar get to call themselves patent attorneys. And it is a special designation. I mean, you cannot legally call yourself a patent attorney if you have not done both, right? Oh. You do not legally hold a state bar registration patent registration number. So okay. I hope that helps explain it. A little long-winded, but it's fun to explain it.
No, it's not. Yeah. I mean, I think that people get caught up in just the lingo of patents and trademarks and all, but they never really know where that comes from and how hard it really is, you know, for you guys to be able to, and just, I can only imagine how many changes and updates to the laws and different things that come through every year that you guys got to keep up on. And so it is interesting. And I think that's why I wanted to kind of get it out there. We got an email about it. We get several emails about it. And it's great that you explained it because I don't think anyone thinks this, or they shouldn't think this. I don't want them to think it's easy. One, I want them to realize that, you know, when you're dealing with somebody who really is a patent attorney and does this for a living, that that it's imperative that you go see someone like yourself, because it's not easy and you got to know your stuff. So, but you know, that brings us right into it. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, what a really at the beginning of what a patent is and consists of. I think it's a great intro into it.
Yeah, totally. And you know, this is sort of this should help people kind of realize, okay, there are easy, you know, I'm not afraid to ask questions because there are no dumb questions. You know, I love any questions. People that are curious about this, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing what we're doing. And the question today, what is a patent? Okay. It's awesome. I'm happy to answer this. I could talk for hours, but I'm going to try to just keep it pretty succinct and Carmine, keep me on track. In order to talk about a patent, I'll probably have to touch on what a patent is not. Mm-hmm. Right. And some of the differences between patents and trademarks and copyrights and, these other areas of IP.
Great.
So at its core, patents come get their authority and their reason for being from the Constitution, from way back. And I love this because it's one of the oldest documents in the U.S. It's in Article 1, Clause 8. Okay, Article 1, Clause 8. I'm not going to be able to quote it exactly, but it bestows a right to authors and inventors for a limited time, a monopoly for giving up what they know. Okay. So it sort of incentivizes authors and creators and inventors to tell the world, to register, to publicize what they've come up with. And in exchange for, you know, telling the world about this greatest, newest gadget or widget or invention, the U.S. government is going to be giving a limited monopoly, the ability to control the big four rights, right of use, making, selling, and importing. Those are the big ones. Make, use, sell, and import. Those are the big ones into the U.S., right? I'm not going to get into international law right now, but for now, let's just focus on the U.S. And that's really at its heart. And the writers of the Constitution, when they put this in, this was a time where there were, I mean, lots of different factions and groups and hidden societies, you know, like the Masons and different organizations that would, you know, basically have large pull in the market by having these products or services or antidotes and different things they would have back then. And no one knew how they could make them, you know, and their technology in a lot of cases would persist, you know, for a long time. And they were just starting to get universities set up and people were trying to get educated and form societies, form cities, you know, and have them have their own legs. And this was, I believe one of the reasons why they did it was so that we would all become smarter. There would be sort of this playing field that for each area of industry and science, that there would be a reason to want to share your knowledge. That's really it. You know, and incentivize knowledge sharing is really what the patent law was put in place for, and to prevent this sort of, you know, hiding of and secrecy that doesn't really help a society grow. And you know, I think in a large part, I think it was a success. You know, it still is a success. That's why it's still around, because it does, in the end, help people become smarter. When you file a patent application, after 18 months, it gets published. And, you know, there are ways to file a secrecy order and to keep it unpublished, but you lose a lot of your privileges if you do that, meaning you don't get to use that as a basis to file internationally if you file a non-publication request. And there's some extra fees involved in that and a scrutiny there because it's frowned upon, right? It sort of is against the grain. The founders wanted publication. But a lot of the reasons for doing that is because it's sort of during pendency or it's a potential hazard to humans. Like if it's like a drug or a medicine that's undergoing testing and they're, you know, they haven't actually proven all the models yet, they're saying, hey, look, we don't want to get this in the public before we're sure that it's safe. You know, those are potential reasons that would actually get by and would allow a privacy secrecy order. There actually are a few that we've worked on where the government will put a secrecy order on. And the Department of Defense will get a hold of these and they screen every single application. So it's rare, but it does come up where they're going to say, hey, look, for whatever reason, we're not going to allow this to get to the public. And there's a full separate channel where that goes. The vast majority of applications get published for the very reason of getting the word out and moving technology forward. So let's see, what is a patent? So,
you know, hey, before you do that, do you get a lot of inventors? I know at Inventors Launchpad here, we get a lot of people that want to keep their stuff secret, and we kind of try to explain to them, as you're saying, that with patent, it's going to be published. Do you get a lot of inventors who don't realize that and say, I don't want it to be published?
Well, there's a definite like feeling, major gut. Like, oh my gosh, what? Like, wait, before I get the grants, before I get the rights, you're saying it's going to get published.
Yeah.
And so what I kind of do that is I kind of turn that around and help them motivate and say, look, you better get started. Either running your own business or getting this off the ground. You know, you're not going to keep this a secret if you want to get those rights. So it lights a fire. Definitely. Yeah. It's a definite big emotional thing. We help coach people through that, but it really, I love, you know, motivating them, helping them think about how they're going to bring it to market.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. And to me, it does. It lights a fire. They realize, you know, I've been talking about this for 5 years. Now I'm moving forward. I better keep it moving forward. And I think that Whether they like it or not, it certainly helps most of the percentage of inventors. It helps them keep things moving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we can have a good talk about trade secrets, and I'll keep the most part of this discussion for a different chat, but it's a big decision on whether you want to keep something as a trade secret. And there is a place for a trade secret. And it, usually circles around this idea of, you want to patent technology that is going to be easy to be reverse engineered when you sell it. Okay. And so if you sell it, a new watch or, a new ballpoint pen, could your competitor break it apart, take the parts and see how you put that spring together, or how you got that ink to come through from the actual product? Could they physically reverse engineer, or, technically through computer technology, reverse engineer what you're doing and replicate it? If you think they could, then you really should be seeking patent protection for that. But if it's more akin to, Coca-Cola and the liquid you're producing, no matter what they do, they can boil it down and try to get all its elements. They can't figure out the timing and the heat and the proportions and all that just right. There's really no reason for you to seek patent protection. And so it's not smart for you to try to seek a patent, because you can keep that a secret, much like Coke has for over 100 years. So there's that discussion as well. So sometimes it is a good idea to keep things secret, not file for patent protection. So a patent itself, it's a, actually I've got a copy of one, so this will be interesting.
Oh, you got it. Okay, great. Cool.
Yeah. One of our clients says, this is kind of funny. What does it look like?
Yeah. Yeah.
The ribbon copy of a patent, right? Maybe get some reflection, and it looks kind of old school, I get some scrolling, letters, and it's going to have the director's name at the bottom. So it's just kind of fun to actually see the document. This one in particular is on a pretty cool lighting device. It's actually for this specific application is for marijuana. It's actually able to grow based on the way it lights, and the pattern and sequence and the type of light helps the plant bud and provide a higher concentration for medicinal marijuana. Wow. So yeah, there's all kinds of applications. The world of patenting is so broad, and that's why I love it. It's just innovations everywhere. So the actual document looks like that. It's kind of fun. I like to show people that are watching, have that as their, in their goal library, at least they can picture, getting that patent. So those four rights, of making the invention, selling the invention, importing it, and make, use, sell, and import. What's nice about having a patent, once you get through the process, is having those rights and being able to exclude others. It's really, the rights are really exclusionary. So you have sort of a shield in that regard, and sort of an analogy to prevent anyone else from doing that. But as it happens in the real world, you've got to be proactive and enforce your rights. It's not going to happen. Infringers aren't going to knock on your door and say, "Can I please get a license to use your technology?" They're going to just be out there. They're going to be out selling and making things because that's what people do. People will be out there in society trying to do their best in business and just in life. And as a patent holder, it's really your duty and your job to enforce your rights. And so you can hire a professional, absolutely. You can do it yourself. It could be a lot of work, making sure you monitor the market, look at the areas of technology that you've got a patent in to make sure that no one is infringing. You can do this in a couple ways. One is to actually be in business. It's a great thing to be doing while you're in business is to monitor the market. Right, you're in the process. You're in the process of making these lights. Like we had this example. You're going to want to know, right? Who are you buying your lights from? Maybe who else are they selling to? And being knowledgeable about what else is out there. It's going to be smart for you to, in terms of how to price your system. You're going to want to look at competitors. You should be definitely sure to look what else is being sold and published in today. in your area, in your industry. And if you see something that looks similar to your invention, it's worth your while to begin the enforcement process and work with a patent attorney. The way that starts is usually with an infringement analysis. One thing that can precede that would be an opinion on validity. So more and more with regard to computerized inventions and software, especially, there's been a lot of concern. You know, rights holders that have gotten patents issued, you know, in the past 5 to 10 years are really worried that, gosh, is my software invention, my business method that I have patented, would this hold up if I were to go sue a big company? Because we've seen these decisions come down. We've heard the media that, oh, you know, software inventions are gone or, you know, very hard to get and courts are striking them down. And so it's really important you come talk to a patent attorney because they understand the law and they understand where the judges have ruled, how the cases have come down and where the line is on eligibility under Section 101 of the patent code, which is now really clear about software inventions. And it's talking about abstract ideas and making sure that your invention is not akin to an abstract idea, much like, you know, a law of gravity or, you know, some sort of a equation or algorithm, something that's performed, you know, purely in the ether, you know, databases talking to databases using just kind of numerical values and inputs, you know, without any real draw to the physical world. That's going to be something that the courts will probably see as an abstract idea. If you're purely just punching numbers and doing things that are, you know, much akin to a calculator, then it's not going to be patentable. So it's certainly something we do is provide opinions for people that, hey, you know, they come to us and they see someone infringing. You know, they've done a good job, monitored the market, and they see someone, hey, you know, I think they're doing what we've got a patent on. They're infringing our patent. And while we want to oftentimes start with an infringement analysis and, you know, send them a nasty gram, cease and desist letter, it's important a lot of times to do that validity of work and take a look at what claims they have written down and make sure that we sort of put ourselves in the shoes of the PTAB, which is the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. They will do that analysis I just talked about and whether it's abstract or not, and to make sure those claims would hold up. Right. If we were to go sue, you know, write that nasty letter and it goes to trial, would those claims hold up if they tried to invalidate the claims under the law the way it is today? So once that opinion is done, let's say, yeah, we do. We think these claims are valid and we believe it would be upheld. Then we do the infringement analysis. Okay, you look at those claims and, you know, the claims of patent. It's a whole discussion. I mean, you can tell, like, there's a lot to say. All right. So the claim of the patent, you know, a lot of people, when they look at a patent, they're like, oh, okay, cool. You know, this flow chart, you know, gosh, all these words, you know, oh, cool diagrams and pictures, nice device. But the actual patent, what they have rights on, they tuck it way at the end. All right. And it's on this part. I don't know if you can read it, but it's I claim. You know, okay. It's the very bottom. It's a list, a numbered list. That is what they own. It's nothing. They don't own anything about these images or pictures or specification. This is what the patent office says they own. So it's usually a much smaller part of the technology. And for this specific one, I mean, we've defined specific wavelengths of light, right? You know, 630 nanometers to 690 nanometers directed within specific numbers of minutes. You know, and so people generally see an invention like, oh, gosh, that's already been done. Or they're definitely infringing. Look at what they're selling. Well, you've got to know your claims and what the words say in order to really assess infringement. And so what we do is we'll talk to the client. After we've done the opinion, we'll say, we'll take a look at the claim. Oh, okay. Wow. So you know, you got a patent. Great. But, you know, and it's covering, you know, a specific type of metal. You know, maybe it's covering, you know, specific types of shapes of metals for that device, you know, and, okay, so what you're telling us, and we've got a couple images, and we compare what they own versus what's being published and sold as the alleged infringement. And we do a step-by-step, claim-by-claim analysis to really see if their rights are being infringed or not. And in almost every case, it's usually infringement not as clear as they thought it was, because it's just tough. It takes a lot of analysis, takes really careful eye. But what's nice is if there is infringement, you've got a bulletproof case against the other side, and 99%+ of the time, once we do that type of an opinion, the letter we send, I mean, it's going to, boom, I mean, it hits. And if there's an attorney on the other side, they're going to be like, wow, we need to settle. You know, we do not want to go to court, you know, and that's the way we act. You know, I'm not going to name any, there are firms that will just write letters, you know, and they'll just skip those two steps of the validity and the infringement opinion, and they'll just shoot out, much like our client, oh, they're infringing, oh, you know, and they'll send that nasty gram without having done that work. And in my opinion, that's really, it's sanctionable. It's malpractice. You know, it's quite horrible, you know, to have not done your homework and to just sort of start a potentially frivolous lawsuit. You know, so that's one big thing that, you know, we see, and it's just ugly. But, you know, that's why you want to make sure you work with the right firm that that does their work, does the diligence, knows about the infringement in detail before they send those types of letters.
Yeah. I noticed here, we had a few of our inventors notice some products on the market. It happens, and you probably get a lot of it. It happens, and the inventors are very emotionally attached. So anything that was close, they were very very diligent, you know, to check and make sure. But what we found is that a lot of people, even they might be infringing and they don't even know they are. It's not like they're bad people. I mean, does that seem like it happens? They just didn't know. They just were making the same type of product or something close.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it happens all the time. Yeah. And that's why we do recommend a soft approach of the, not such a huge aggressive stance, you know, making sure they have notice of the potential infringement and see how they react. We have had folks that are just like, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe it. You know, we'll, no problem. We'll stop production. Tell me what I got to do. And they'll cooperate. And you don't need to, you know, flex your muscles and act like a jerk. You know, you can get it done. I've seen it done without us getting involved. So without attorneys, you can do that. Just give them a call, email. Look, you know, it looks like, and be nice. It appears, you know, from what I can tell, you know, this does seem to read on the claims of my patent. Are you open to having a discussion? Someone that's open-minded and understanding will probably comply. Mm-hmm. You know, probably we want to work with you. I do think it's worthwhile talking with an attorney. Just make sure you know your options. You know, there's a lot of time really good upside to that. If someone's already done the work and lined up a supplier and a manufacturer and has the product on the shelves already, gosh, why not just try to license? You know, get them a license and you know, monetize your invention.
Yeah.
So those are the types of things that firms like ours do, and we can help you draw up an agreement. You know, we make a nice royalty, and everybody wins in that case.
Yeah, that I would definitely agree with you 100%. But what I would mention is like what you said is before you make that phone call, send JD an email or give him a call or give your attorney a call, because you want to say the right things, and if possible, have someone else call if you're not, unless you can handle it or not be too emotionally attached to it, because, you know, again, the other person is going to be emotionally attached. So sometimes it's better to get some people together that, that may not be emotional about it. But as JD said, most people aren't doing it on purpose. I don't think I've run into one where they knew, that it was. So I agree. It's great advice, JD, is no doubt about it. Real quick, can you give by the way, the patent explanation was awesome. I'm glad the listeners are going to get that out of it. The different types of patents, real quick. I mean, we're running out of time, but what are the different types of patents that are out there? Because this sometimes gets me.
Yeah, no, this is good. Thank you. I should have talked about this. So there are three major types. There's one called the utility patent, and that's what most people think of, and that's kind of what I was describing most of the time. That's when you've got a patent that has functionality, right? It has real functionality, usefulness about it. That's what's being protected, is what's functional. So the utility patents. There are design patents that you get 14 years after issue is the, so it's a little bit smaller time frame. For utility patents, you get 20 years from the date of application. Design patents are 14 years from the date of issue. Design patents are not about the functionality. It protects just the way something looks. Okay, so just the aesthetics, the ornamentation, and the shapes, but not what it does. The applications are a lot shorter. You know, it's just the images. You really only have to claim in words. You say, hey, what's shown in the image? It's very simple. And you get lots of different views, don't get me wrong. And you can protect things that are quite complicated through design patents. The third type is the most rare. It's called a plant patent. And it's what you think of. It's something that grows. This is, and it's a weird name, but it's asexually reproducible, meaning it can be produced in a lab setting, right? And so once you figure out that strain and the way it can grow, as if it's novel, non-obvious, and has a functionality. So it's similar to utility in that aspect, but it's something that grows. It's from nature. It can be protected under plant patents, has a 20-year same window as utility. There are some additional requirements to actually sending in a specimen for analysis. You know, they actually had that requirement way back for utility inventions. You had to send in your invention, but it became onerous, right? You know, there's not enough space, right? We're almost at 10 million patents now.
I would love to have seen that warehouse.
We're out of room. Just send us a picture. That'd be great. Yeah. Like, you know, but yeah, the plant deal, we had a couple folks that have done applications. We ended up bringing another specialist because of the specific area. But there are applications, they get filed quite a bit on things like fruits, you know, pineapples, apple orchards, you know, and hops. And while people want to protect things like marijuana, they're not, it's still a federally controlled substance. And I know there's just an announcement by the Trump administration of kind of a, you know, to buttress that, you know, the fact that, hey, this is still illegal. There's no way you could ever send a specimen using the Federal Postal Service. So it just wouldn't work. We don't recommend it. I think that is going to happen eventually. So, that aside, anything you can grow is potentially predictable. There is one cool thing about plant patents that I kind of like, in that there's a small carve out for discovering. So pure discovery, not inventorship. So if you're out there and you discover a plant, a new and novel plant that has functionality, it's possible you can get a plant protection over a naturally developed piece of horticulture. So it's out there, it's rare. It's an interesting part. Those are the big three. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, no, definitely helps. It's funny because I have another question. We're gonna have so many shows.
And yeah,
just real quick, and I know that we're running out of time, why the difference in years? What's the big deal? Why 20? Why 14? Why? And if we don't know, it's okay. We'll cover it in a different show. It's just weird to me that it's different.
Well, they want rights. Yeah, I don't know. I would only be speculating that they're actually trying to get the actual duration of enforceability to be equivalent. They've kept it at 20 years for utility because sometimes it takes 4 years, 5 years to get through the patent system. Issued, and design patents can shoot through.
Okay, that makes sense.
9 months. So the pendency issue, I think that's one of the reasons why they're trying to do that. And you know, they don't want people to block out areas of innovation. So what people can do, and although people will try, think of the iPhone, they'll get both utility and a design protection. They don't want one to
expire.
They don't want you to have more than that 20 years. So they wouldn't want you to get a utility patent, use it for 20 years, then get a design patent.
Ah, okay.
So they want them to run at the same time, roughly the same time period.
That makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I could go back and think on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're going to cover so much. I mean, just in trademarks and so many different things. That's what I love about getting the show going, because every listener is going to have multiple questions. I mean, just somebody who's running a business gets a patent, and then they're going to start a business. There's going to be so many more things that the show is going to cover for them. It's just awesome. And that's why, as you're talking, I'm like scrolling down several more questions. It's going to be nonstop.
I know. It's pretty fun. We'll make it organic. We'll try to have one or two major themes, but yep, you're right. It's going to go in different directions. I'm glad we got a few questions from last time. I'm guessing we're going to get some more from today.
Yeah. So, questions, how should they get in touch with you?
Sure. Yeah. So the main way is to go to our website. And our first thing we've make a priority in our business is education. So going to boldip.com, that's boldip.com, and check out our services page. Look at our homepage. We have a lot of good information there. We've got our phone number right there on the website. For those listeners maybe that can't go online, it's 800-849-1913. So 800-849-1913. Reno or Megan will be ready to take your call. Mm-hmm. And then I'm open to email. If you guys want to email me, I will respond within a business day at jd@boldip.com.
It's awesome. We don't get too many attorneys giving out their email address, so it's awesome, man. And you know what? This is such a hot topic, and that's why I am so grateful you're giving your time for this show. We're going to do a lot of shows. We're going to put a lot of information out there. And, I don't think that listeners realize, what listening and getting education from somebody like you is worth. I mean, it's all education purposes, but this is a lot of info that we're going to be giving out. So I think it's just awesome.
Me too. Yeah, this is excellent. Thank you to the Inventors Launchpad. We're excited about this year. It's fun as I get talking, the time just ticks by. We're already at the end. So you're right. We'll be hitting a lot of subjects, and I'm excited about how well you guys have been able to put out the material. So, looking
forward to 100%, man. Time's going. I got my producer across from me going. But no, it's a lot of fun. And I know it's going to, the time just goes by. I'm watching the clock tick away and I'm going, man, I got all these questions. So it's all good. Thank you all to all of our listeners. I know you got a lot of choices out there to tune into. Podcasts are awesome. A lot of audio books, a lot of things. And we appreciate you. JD and I both appreciate you spending your time with us and listening to us, and to all you people that are sending some emails out, all you listeners sending emails to us and leaving reviews on iTunes and Google Play. We really appreciate our listeners, and we're here to help as in any way possible. So again, for JD and myself, we thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Go Bold IP Show.
Go bold at boldip.com.